The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show. Q&A edition right now, today. And once again, I'm flying solo. This is Chris of the Chris and Jim team. So, Jim, I'm expecting to be back next week on one of next week's, or maybe both of next week's shows. So, look forward to that. We've got a handful of questions here on the Q&A. Thank you very much, everyone, for sending in questions. It keeps our hopper full, if you know what I mean. So, I think I've got five questions, not super long, any one individual question. So, I'm hoping I can get through all five. Actually, I bet I can get through all five in a, not even in a super extended length Q&A show. So in no particular order, we've got a question here coming in about IRAs, looks like. So we've got a question. They don't indicate where they're sending us this email from, but it's pretty recent, from November here, mid-November. And it reads the following. It says, "Dear Jim and Chris, enjoy your informative show. I recently read something about, read something about the primary beneficiary being able to disclaim a portion of an inherited IRA and the contingent beneficiaries then receiving the disclaimed amount. Would you explain what this is and why anyone who's a primary beneficiary would want to do this?" So, nice and short question. Topic we don't talk about a ton. We've talked about disclaiming strategies before, so this isn't a brand new, never been spoken of topic on the Q&A show here. But essentially, yes, you can do this, disclaim. You can, and this isn't just IRAs, right? When you inherit something, you're not forced. It's not like someone who passes away can force someone to take something. You cannot burden someone with something they did not want. Classic case of this is I always remind people who might have timeshares that they're not maybe as enthusiastic about as when they first purchased it, when they went on vacation and met the nice salesperson who gave them a really compelling presentation about why they should buy into this timeshare and described it as nothing but roses and rainbows. And then over time, it turned out not to be quite so attractive. And so people find that they're unable to unload said timeshare. And they say, well, let's just go ahead and keep it. We'll leave it to the kids. Well, I always remind the kids, you don't have to take it. You can disclaim it. And you don't have to take on the burden of those maintenance fees and everything just because you're going to receive it, just because you were named. Does not mean that you have to. You can disclaim it. So this has nothing to do with an IRA specifically. Doesn't have anything specifically to do with a timeshare, but that's a classic case where I always remind people that one can disclaim an inheritance. So an IRA is the same way. You're going to have a beneficiary named, hopefully, if you're following the general guidance, certainly something we reinforce here. Make sure that you have a beneficiary named on your IRA, and most of the time, make sure it's not a trust for reasons beyond the scope of this show. Want to remind you that trusts and IRAs mix like oil and water, so you better have a darn good reason for naming a trust as beneficiary. There are reasons, but if you do not have one of the compelling reasons, it's best not to do that. Also, do not name your estate as the beneficiary of an IRA. Again, there's almost never a good reason to do that, and I almost never means almost never. I'll leave open the possibility that occasionally you could find a compelling reason to do so, but the power of the beneficiary designation is it bypasses probate, it bypasses the normally estate procedures, it goes directly to the person you want to get it nice and cleanly, and so why give up that power when you can name a person as the beneficiary? So you'll have a primary beneficiary on your IRA, and it could be multiple people. You can have multiple primaries, and you can even designate percentages. You can say, I want 30% here, 20% there, etc. But you're going to have a primary or primaries named as beneficiary of the IRA. And a contingent beneficiary, a lot of people don't have contingents. They just assume that the primary is going to be available and alive. Maybe not the best assumption to make, but a contingent is there if the primary or primaries are not available, are not living anymore, or for some reason can't take it, or they disclaim it, it goes to the contingent instead of then falling on the default mode of the custodial agreement with the IRA. So that's why if you're naming beneficiaries, you may as well put a contingent on there so that you have control over who gets it if the primary can't take it or doesn't want to take it, thus disclaiming. So that's the procedure, essentially. What is this? That is what that is disclaiming an inheritance and saying, I'm stepping outside, I'm stepping back, I do not want this. But his other question is, why would a person want to do this? They've just inherited an IRA, money in it. Why would they want to disclaim? Well, this is often done on purpose for a few common reasons. And one would be that the primary beneficiary, maybe a spouse or a sister or brother, you might want to be sure to take care of them first, but you're unsure if they're going to need it. And if they don't need it, you want it to go to fill in the blank as contingent. Could be a charity, could be another person, etc. But you tell the primary, I'm going to name you primary, and if you need it, go ahead and take it. Go ahead and accept it. But if you don't need it, simply disclaim, and it will go directly to the contingent. You don't then have to worry about, because if the person, the primary, takes it, they can't just hand it over to the other person cleanly. So it's better for them to step back and let the beneficiary designation control who it goes to, and you'll have a contingent or contingents mentioned or listed on the beneficiary designation form. And if the primary disclaims, the contingent gets it. And you can disclaim a partial. You don't have to do the whole thing. You can say, no, I'll take half of it. The other half, I'm going to disclaim and let that go. So the person... So in that case, that's very common when someone would take advantage of a disclaiming strategy. They would be put in a position to accept it if they need it, and if they don't, they step back and let the contingent have some or all of it. The other reason is maybe you know you want it to go to, say, some kids or a younger person, and you're worried that they're going to inherit it or be the beneficiary at too young of an age or before they've matured enough emotionally and financially and have enough common sense to handle it. So essentially you're worried that maybe you'll have an early death and this beneficiary thing will come into play sooner than later. And if they're old enough, you have no problem with it going to the kids. If your kids are 50 years old and fully functional, well, thoughtful, responsible adults, no problem. But if they're still 30 and haven't fully matured, or they're maybe going through a divorce, or they're going through some other issues, maybe in bankruptcy, or who knows what, you can put kind of a gatekeeper in. So instead of naming the kids directly as primary, you name your brother or someone, but with the express instructions that you kind of have a conversation on the side. This isn't really intended for you, but I'm going to trust you that if there's some good reason to not let it flow to my kids, to protect it ultimately for them in the long term, you can accept it. But the intent is for you actually to step out of the way and disclaim it. That's what the intent is. And if everything's fine, that's exactly what you'll do. But you're the gatekeeper and could stop it from becoming a nightmare or an unfortunate circumstance from a tax standpoint or a creditor standpoint or a loss standpoint for some other reason by having this gatekeeper. So those are the common reasons why you might have a disclaiming strategy kind of thought of ahead of time. Those are kind of part of a pre-planned strategy. Disclaiming can happen without a pre-plan, right? You suddenly it comes and the person, the primary beneficiary, for whatever reason, doesn't want to accept it or prefers not to accept it. They are allowed to disclaim. So a couple rules you need to be aware of if you do disclaim. The disclaiming has to happen within 9 months of the IRA owner's death. And so there's a time limit here. You can't hold it for 20 years and then, you know, try to disclaim. That's not going to work. It's got to be within 9 months of the IRA owner's death. And nothing of value can be taken from the IRA during this period. If you take anything from it, it's considered to be not disclaimed. Okay, so the disclaiming has to happen first before you use the rest. You can't take some of it and then you say, oh, the rest I want to disclaim. The taking of some of it is going to shut the disclaiming door, so be sure you know that. Although the IRS has ruled that taking an RMD, so a year of death RMD from the IRA, does not count as closing, you know, as a distribution of value for closing of the disclaiming window. So be worried about that. You also have to have the contingent beneficiaries preloaded on the beneficiary designation form. The primary beneficiary can't say, well, I'm going to disclaim and I want it to go to Georgette over there. And if you don't have control, the primary beneficiary actually hasn't accepted it to be able to have control over it. If they accept it, they haven't disclaimed. If they disclaim, it was never theirs to control in the first place. So they cannot define or determine where it goes if they disclaim. So make sure you've preloaded this the contingent beneficiary entry on the beneficiary designation form with those you would want to get it if the primary disclaims. And I already mentioned that disclaiming is not an all or nothing proposition. You can do a partial disclaimer, but that has to be done first. Like I said, you can't use half of it and then try to disclaim. You have to do the disclaiming of half of it first before the primary beneficiary takes the other half for their own use. So pretty straightforward, I think, but hopefully that clarified what that person was looking for. Okay, the next question here, it happens to be a Social Security question. So this is also very short. I like these really short ones. It lets us get right to the answer very quickly. This one is from Texas, actually. I can tell because they reference TRS. So I'm 68 and drawing Social Security and a pension. My wife is 62. She has a TRS pension. TRS stands for Texas Retirement System. I guess I better find out what the Tennessee retirement system is called because I've only seen TRS as Texas, but maybe I just haven't run across a Tennessee one yet, but I can tell from their email address they're from Texas. So this one's definitely Texas, but I apologize if I'm just assuming that TRS always means Texas. Somebody in Tennessee can maybe let me know if they've got another acronym or initialism that they use for their pension. But back to the email. My wife's 62. She has a TRS pension. She will be eligible to take the spousal benefit at 66 and a half. I'm assuming he means the spousal benefit of Social Security. She's actually eligible right now. She's 62, and you are currently collecting Social Security. So I wanted to clarify that. She's not eligible to take the full spousal benefit at 62. It would be reduced for her claiming early. But 66 and a half must be her full retirement age, and so she would be eligible for a full spousal benefit at that time, or eligible to claim it. Whether she gets it or not will be the subject of the conversation here, I'm sure. Should we wait until then, or what would be the best time to file for that? Well, it's possible that question is moot because she may very well not qualify to receive a dime of a spousal benefit, and let me explain why. You don't mention that your wife has Social Security at all. So that tells me that she worked in the TRS, Texas Retirement System, for quite some time. It's not like she worked elsewhere and then was part of Texas Retirement System. The vast majority of school districts that are part of the Texas Retirement System do not participate in Social Security. So in other words, the TRS pension is a replacement for Social Security, not an alongside like he must have. So he's saying he's drawing Social Security and a pension, but he doesn't say TRS pension. So he must have a pension that was not a substitute. This TRS pension is what's called a non-covered pension. It's not also covered by Social Security system. And almost for sure, that's her case. Otherwise, he would have mentioned she has her own Social Security benefit too. If she paid into both, she'd also have a Social Security benefit. But the fact that she doesn't means she was in TRS, didn't generate a Social Security benefit from outside work, and this is all she has. So this means she's going to be subject to GPO, the government pension offset. So the government pension offset is meant to level the playing field for people that have one of these non-covered pensions, which in her case means she hasn't generated her own Social Security benefit, but it's not like she doesn't have a pension-like benefit. She has an actual pension. She just doesn't have a Social Security. If she had Social Security and had worked her entire life, they would pay her own benefit because it would be bigger than the spousal, so Social Security wouldn't be on the hook for a spousal. The point of GPO is not to have a TRS-style non-covered pension make it look like she has no Social Security or equivalent, thus causing Social Security to have to pay her a spousal benefit, when in fact she has maybe a big old TRS pension off to the side, which if she had a big old Social Security benefit, she wouldn't get a spousal benefit on his record anyway. So GPO isn't particularly unfair. Actually, I don't think it's unfair at all. WEP, I'm not a big fan of, but that's not party to this since we're talking about the spousal benefit. GPO affects the spousal benefit and any potential survivor benefit. We're focused on the spousal benefit here first. So because she's going to be affected by GPO, that means any spousal or survivor benefit for which she would be eligible on someone else's Social Security record, in this case her husband, would be reduced $2 for every $3 of her pension. So whatever pension she has, two-thirds of that, they're going to use to reduce the spousal or survivor benefit. So let me give you some rough numbers here, or some basic numbers to illustrate what happens in a case like this. Let's assume that the author of this email, the husband, has a primary insurance amount or full retirement age benefit of $2,000. Let's make it a nice round number, $2,000. And let's say that the wife has a TRS pension benefit of $1,500 per month. I have no idea what they are because he didn't supply that, but this would be a common scenario. $1,500 bucks a month. She's got a potential spousal benefit of half of his PIA. So when she reaches her full retirement age, which he indicated was 66 and a half, if she was eligible, totally eligible to receive it, she could file and get $1,000 a month off of his record. Even if she never worked a day in her life, never had any Social Security benefit. However, she has a TRS pension. The GPO offset is two-thirds of that $1,500. Well, in my math, two-thirds of $1,500 is $1,000. So that spousal benefit to which she would otherwise be entitled is completely eliminated. It's taken away. Now, it's not that she gets nothing. They're just saying, look, you have a Social Security equivalent. You have this pension over there, we're not going to pay you a spousal, just like we wouldn't pay you a spousal if you had a big, you know, decent sized Social Security benefit of your own. So in this way, it does equalize things for people between a couple of both having Social Security and a case like this where one has Social Security, the other has a non-covered pension. So that's what I mean by this isn't this is not really unfair at all. Now, that's a spousal, so she's probably not going to get anything. Now, if her TRS pension is small, or your and or your Social Security benefit, the husband's benefit is extremely large, right? 2,000 is still already above average, but maybe it's maxed out. We don't know what the numbers are. Maybe she'd qualify for some of this benefit. And I don't know without the numbers, but I think it's possible, actually, better than 50-50, she's not going to get a dime on a spousal benefit. Potential survivor benefit, though, is the full $2,000, meaning if he were to pass away, the husband were to pass away, the $2,000 that he was receiving would actually be going to her as a survivor. Remember, spousal is half of that amount. Survivor is 100% of that amount. And GPO would still apply, so they'd reduce it by 1,000, but because the survivor's 1,000, she'd be left with 1,000. So she would get part of his, half of his Social Security benefit, and still keep 100% of her own TRS pension. So that's how things are going to work here. He didn't ask me about the survivor benefit, but I wanted to throw that in there, because just because you don't maybe qualify or get a spousal doesn't mean you also would be barred from receiving any survivor benefit. They're going to look at the math and see if her TRS pension's big enough, then no, she wouldn't get anything from his, which again, people might say, oh, that's not fair. Well, if her Social Security benefit was bigger than his, she also wouldn't get a dime of his if he passed away. So that's why this GPO thing isn't really unfair. So that's what's going on here. We're not going to talk about WEP because that would only apply to her own benefit. And he doesn't mention anything about her having her own benefit. Strangely enough, on the TRS pension, if he's named as survivor and she's chosen the 100% survivor option, when she passes away, he would get the full $1,500 a month with no reduction. GPO doesn't apply to him because he's not the one that had the non-covered pension. Just because he's the survivor beneficiary of it doesn't mean he's going to be subject to GPO. He paid into Social Security, so he'll keep his Social Security, he'll keep his pension, and get the survivor pension if it was chosen on the TRS from his wife. So maybe added too much to that, hopefully not too much to confuse people, but the ultimate question, what would be the best time to file for that? I would need to know the dollar amounts and even if she qualifies, because I think it's likely it's not even worth asking because she's not going to get a dime. But if this person, once you hear this, if you want to follow up with me with some more specifics, I'd be happy to pencil it out for you and give you, instead of this hypothetical example like I did here, it'd be just take me 2 seconds to give you an example that applied more to your specific circumstances. Okay. So that was a good question. Question three here is going to be on, what have we got here? Also a super short one. Boy, this is the land of short email questions. That's excellent. This one is from Ohio. So nice short email from Ohio. You recently went into great detail about ERISA's rules around spouses as 401k beneficiaries. That's a common topic that comes up quite a lot. So I don't know when he listened to it. This email is recent, from October, so within the last 60 days or so. His question, what are the rules when there is a divorce and the ex-spouse has been given a portion of the 401k as part of the divorce decree? Let me stop right there. 401ks are ERISA-controlled plans. ERISA plans are split in a divorce via a quadro, QDRO, Qualified Domestic Relations Order, which, as we've discussed in the past, starts as a DRO, a Domestic Relations Order, as drafted by and signed off by the judge in the divorce case. That is then the DRO is sent to the 401k plan administrator, who then looks through it and makes sure it qualifies to affect the ERISA-based plan. And then once they sign off on it, it becomes a quadro, QDRO. So divorce decree doesn't split that. A divorce decree splits IRAs. So some people say, well, quadro applies to everything in the retirement planning space. Nope. ERISA plans are quadroed. Non-ERISA controlled plans are split with a divorce decree. Anyway, just wanted to clear that up right there. He goes on, if the ex-spouse has not remarried, can they safely, and he puts in quotes, safely, name their children as the beneficiaries of the 401k? Enjoy the show and the way you go into detail around each topic. Thanks, from Ohio. And then puts a strange comment at the end, P.S. Browns versus Bears in the Super Bowl. I have the benefit of observing that comment in December when there's a lot more information out there. I would put a fair amount of money on Browns and Bears not being in the Super Bowl this year. But back to the question. So this all hinges on this rule, this ERISA rule, that if you're married, the spouse has an automatic built-in right of claim as a survivor, as a beneficiary of your 401k. For you to name someone else as beneficiary of your 401k, your spouse has to consent, has to agree, and sign a document that says so. And they can't sign it preemptively before you get married, so you can't make it part of like a prenuptial arrangement. Only a spouse can, I won't call it disclaim, but consent. And so you have to wait till you're married, and they have to consent. So here they were spouses. A divorce happened. The quadro split the 401k between these two folks. And he's asking, now that it's split and this quadro is in effect, can this now ex-spouse that holds part of the 401k after the quadro name kids or anyone else? Yes, because there's no spouse. There's no spouse in effect. Now, strangely enough, if they get remarried, the spousal consent will have to be re-signed. Even if it wasn't your own 401k, say it's, so people can follow this, let's say we have a wife and a husband. The wife has the 401k. Divorce happens. The husband ends up with half of the 401k as part of the quadro. Husband then goes out and gets remarried. The 401k wasn't technically his at work. It wasn't from his work. It was from his ex-wife's work. The spousal consent rules still apply to the best of our knowledge, which means if he does get remarried, and just like if this wasn't a remarriage situation, if you name your kids and then later get married, the fact that the kids were beneficiaries first does not matter. The ERISA rules, where the spouse becomes supreme beneficiary, overriding any other arrangement you've had unless they consent to not being a beneficiary, that applies. So if you were to remarry, you'd want to get that spousal consent signed so it could still go to your kids if you wanted. And they can't sign it before marriage. You can't be, well, you know, let's get all this taken care of before we get married. Go ahead and sign this saying you're not going to try to take my 401k. I haven't heard a specific story, but this opens up the possibility that they say, oh, yeah, no problem. But we have to do it after we get married. I promise I'll do it. You get married, and then they say, well, no. No, I'm not going to sign that consent. They have now got claim to part of your 401k. Now, how that would work out if you immediately turn around and want to divorce the person due to some kind of misrepresentation or something, that's beyond my legal brain, of which I have very little. So just wanted to mention that, though. So you'd want to get a new consent if you got remarried. But because it is a completely separate quadro now, what your ex-spouse is doing doesn't matter. Your ex-spouse is disconnected now from your half that you received in the quadro. So they're not your spouse anymore. So they're not this supreme automatic beneficiary. You are free and clear, quote, safe in your terminology, author of the email, to name your children as the beneficiaries of the 401k. Just remember, if you get married and you want that still to be in effect and you don't want your new spouse to become the default beneficiary, you'll need to get a new spousal consent on that. I think that's all they're asking. Yeah, perfect. So let's see. Next question here. This one is another Social Security question. This one's a bit longer. Originally from Wisconsin, recently moved to Arizona. So a little warmer climate for sure. So this is regarding withdrawal of benefits for Social Security. So he says, hi, few background facts. My full retirement age is 66 and 2 months, which is September of 2021. I started taking Social Security benefits this year, March of 2020. It is now October of 2020, and I'm going to start working full time again and would like to withdraw my Social Security benefit since I am still in the first 12 months. My plan is to work until 70 and start drawing the higher benefit at that time, estimated to be around $3,200 plus. I know I have to pay back all the monies paid to me so far. I have had federal tax taken out of the payment so far, 12% each time. Is that factored into the amount of dollars I have to pay back since I haven't gotten those dollars, or do I get it back at tax time? He has several questions, so let me attack these one at a time. So this is a little background. You can withdraw your Social Security application within 12 months of filing once in a lifetime. You can't do this regularly, but you can do this one time in a lifetime. And as a part of that, all benefits paid on your record to you or other people, if it were on your record, have to be paid back to Social Security, and they will then pretend like you never filed. That's what a withdrawal of application is, and you can only do it within the first 12 months. You put the application in, they will come back and tell you exactly what you have to pay back. You then have a short period of time. I did a previous show on this. I think it's 90 days, maybe. I'd have to go back and look. It's been a couple years since I've done that. And as long as you pay them back within the window, it's been withdrawn. That's what he's talking about doing. I'm not going to talk about whether this is a good idea or a bad idea. He's asking about the mechanics of it. So the first part of the question is, he's had a benefit and 12% has been withheld. He never received it deposited into his account, and it's been sent off as withholding to the IRS. When he has to pay back the money, does he have to pay back 100%, or does he only have to pay back 88% and they claw back the tax money? Nope, they don't claw it back. So you can think of that money that went to the IRS just like withholding at your job. If you had earnings and they were withholding and sending it in, at the end of the year, if it turns out you didn't really owe it, you get it back as a tax refund. That's exactly what's going to happen here. You're going to withdraw the benefit. Social Security will let the IRS know that you have a corrected 1099, essentially. They report your Social Security payments on a 1099 for Social Security. They'll tell the IRS that's been withdrawn. When you file your taxes, you report that this withholding was done and sent to you on my behalf by the Social Security Administration, just like withholding was done on your behalf at your employer, if that were the case. And if you don't owe that money in taxes, it'll come back to you as a tax refund. So that's the first part. You're not going to get the whole thing. You're going to have to pay back 100% of what your benefit was, and then you'll get back the tax part as a tax refund at tax time. Also, since I started Medicare this past July, what happens to the $144 a month that's been taken out for Part B so far? Is that just kept by Social Security, or will I have to make back payments to Medicare? I can't seem to find the answer anywhere, so any help you can give me would be appreciated. So you're not going to have to make back payments. The payments to Medicare have happened. They reduced your Social Security benefits. The way you end up paying for them out of pocket is you're going to have to pay back 100% of the Social Security benefits that were payable to you, just like on the tax side. You're going to pay back 100%, even though they only paid you 88%, because they sent 12% to the IRS, less the $144.60 in Medicare premiums per month. So you didn't get the whole thing back. You're going to have to somehow scratch together 100% of the benefit to pay it back to finalize the withdrawal. So you won't owe anything to Medicare. You've paid it. Where it's going to come out of your pocket is the fact that you have to reimburse it to Social Security because they're not going to get it back from Medicare. It comes from you. Once it gets paid to Medicare, it's there never to be returned. Now, moving forward, since you're not claiming Social Security, where they can then remove it from your Social Security benefit. By the way, if you're claiming Social Security and on Medicare, it is a requirement that they withhold those payments from your Social Security benefit. If you're not claiming Social Security, they have you pay the Medicare premiums out of pocket on a quarterly basis. So that's what you're going to have to do during this period where you're not receiving a Social Security benefit anymore and you're waiting till age 70 to turn it back on. So that's how it'll work moving forward. But the past, nothing you're going to do at Medicare. You're going to simply pay back what Social Security tells you to pay back in the demand letter. They'll say, we received your application. In order to finalize the withdrawal of your application, you must pay us. And there'll be a big number there. The sum total of all the benefits that have been paid to you, whether they got diverted to the IRS or Medicare system or not, that whole thing needs to be paid back. And then you will accomplish what you wanted, the withdrawal. So that answers his question. I want to embellish it one little bit. Let's say you missed it by a month. You weren't within the 12-month period, but you went back to work and you were worried now that you've stuck yourself in a much lower benefit because you claimed early, and maybe he did this at a fairly old age. He was within a year of or so of his, a year and a little bit of his full retirement age, but let's say you turned it on at 62 because you lost your job. And 13 months later, you get a new nice paying job and you want to shut your Social Security off so that you could turn it on at age 70. What's going to happen there? You can't withdraw your application. You used to be able to do it without the 12-month restriction. The 12-month restriction has been around for a long time, but there was actually previously no limit. You could, as long as you paid back, you could claim for years and years and years. And as long as you could find the money to pay it all back, you could do that. Now they limit it to 12 months. So you're in month 13. You can't withdraw. So you're thinking, I've now stuck myself with this little Social Security. Well, not really. You're never going to be able to undo the year that you collected, the 13 months you collected before you got this new job. But if your job pays well, it's going to eliminate all of the Social Security benefit because of the earnings test. Well, what they're going to do with that, even though now you're not going to get a benefit as you're 63, 64, 65, 66, etc., assuming you're working this whole time, when you reach your full retirement age, they will recalculate your benefit as if giving you credit for delaying or not claiming during that time when you were offset 100% with your earnings test. And you could then, at that point at full retirement age, suspend your benefit. That's different than withdrawing. Suspending it, just putting the pause on it, and get you to 70. You won't recapture the year. So withdrawing is a little better in the long run if you're trying to maximize the benefit you could get at 70. You could limit your ability or your pain and suffering of the reduced benefit by earning enough where the earnings test eliminates the benefit payable to you and kind of simulate what he's trying to do here. Get close, but not 100%. So just be aware you can effectively accomplish a suspension of benefits in the early years by earning enough that the earnings test wipes out all of your benefit. They'll give you credit for those years back at your full retirement age. Now, this is just for your own benefit. If the earnings test is offsetting survivor benefits or spousal benefits, you don't get them recalculated later on. So this is unique just to your own retirement benefit. Don't want to go down that rabbit hole too far, but just wanted to be aware, you know, people aware, make them aware that this is just a rule where they recalculate your benefit at your full retirement age, giving you credit for any months you lost due to the earnings test. That's applied just to your retirement benefit alone. Okay. I am going to get through all five of these. So question number five. Here we have, what is this one on? So this has to do with Roth conversions, looks like. So these folks are from Maine, looks like. So we've had Maine, Ohio, Texas, Wisconsin moved to Arizona. We're all over the country. Nothing from California, so nothing directly from the West Coast this time, but pretty good mix today. So here's the email from our listeners in Maine. Hello, Jim and Chris. We would greatly appreciate your wisdom and expertise. Oh, that sounds so formal. Regarding our question, my wife and I, both 56, have each contributed $7,000 to our Roth IRAs for 2020. So that's the limit in 2020 for those 50 or over. We would also like to convert an old IRA to a Roth. Present value is $93,000. My concern is that combined income married filing joint is $160,000. I understand the income limit for contributing to a Roth is $196,000 married filing joint, the $196,000 Maggie, modified adjusted gross income. Over that, the ability to directly contribute to a Roth is reduced or phased out starting at 196. So he's saying that he's close. They have a combined income of 160,000. So they're getting fairly close to the phase out for the Roth contributions. His question, would the conversion cause any problems for the Roth IRA contribution we already made earlier this year? I understand it will put us in the next tax bracket. Can't avoid that, unfortunately. So you're right on that. We would like to retire at 60 and currently have about $1.3 million in a 401k and a 403b, $180,000 in Roths plus amounts in brokerage and investing in HSA accounts. They're wanting to get a little more money in that never taxable category and doing it via Roth combination of making those $7,000 contributions, but they want to increase the amount they have in Roths by doing conversions, and they're worried they're going to undermine their ability to contribute the $7,000 per year by doing the conversion, which will be reported as ordinary income. Good news here. This is actually a pretty simple one. Roth IRA conversions are not counted in the Maggie, the adjusted gross income limits for the trigger the phase out of the Roth contribution. So as long as your regular AGI without the conversion keeps you safe and within range, you know, below the limits for being able and still able to contribute fully to a Roth IRA, the conversion will not affect it no matter what the size. You can convert $1 million. Not that I'd want you to. That'd be a horrific tax bill, but there's the conversion itself does not get counted in that. So you can both convert unlimited amount, you know, based on how much you're willing to pay in taxes, and contribute as long as your other income other than the conversion doesn't get above that 196 figure that you reacted to or you mentioned in your particular email. So good question. That's one that it's sometimes these little nuances. Most of the stuff out there touches on the basics. They mention this stuff, but when you get into the actual application of some of the rules in retirement planning, reality creates these interesting combination questions that aren't nearly as easy to find out. So did want to confirm that. Do want to add one thing. P.S. We also enjoy the many Jimisms and Chris's reactions to them as they mirror ours and make us laugh. So two things. When Jim comes back, I need everyone's support in being able to still react to Jim's Jimisms without people feeling sorry for him and making me out to be the bad guy. So I'll take it kind of easy on him a little bit for a while when he comes back. I'll cut him a little slack, but it's going to be really hard to sit here with a straight face with some of the things that he says. And those of you who've been longtime listeners know exactly what I'm talking about. Jimisms, is they've picked up on that. They must be longtime listeners because I coined that phrase long ago and use it to describe all of the interesting and comical, in my opinion, things that come out of Jim's mouth sometimes. So thank you very much for sending this in. So I got through five. I need to remind, the other thing I'm going to joke with Jim about is that, you know, when I'm alone, I can crank through five questions in 45 minutes. Just, you know, just saying, although he might say, well, okay, congratulations, do all the shows on your own from here on out. So maybe I won't say that to him. But if you want to send in your own question back to the show here, best way to do that is go to our website, jimhelps.com or chrishelps.com. But jimhelps.com, that's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. There's a contact form on there. You can reach out to us, send us a question. You can ask us things not related to the show, certainly. You can also investigate a little bit more about us. We've got information about everyone who works here, works on our team. We have a full team of folks. It's usually just Jim and I on the show here, although Bob's been pitching in too lately. We haven't had Greg on the show for a while. We probably need to do a long-term care refresher show with Greg, who contributes mostly in that arena. We haven't had Scott on the show for a while on the investment side. Scott and Travis are here in the background working on stuff diligently as well. They're not as common on the show, but we do have a full team of folks here. You can get more information about exactly what it is we do and how we do it and our philosophy. Although I always tell people the best way to get a sense for our philosophy and our approach is just to listen to our podcast shows. That'll be far more informative than the website itself, although there's a lot of good stuff on the website. So I want to thank everybody for listening, putting up with me doing these shows solo. I'm sure they're not nearly as interesting as when we've got Jim and his character on the show here. So put up with me a little bit longer. We'll get Jim back on here shortly. And everyone take care for the next week until we come back with a brand new show about a week from now.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.